Exciting news from the EAN. Since January 2025, EAN Campus is open to all associate members. If you're part of a National Neurological Society in Europe, you may already have access. Just log in with your MyEAN account at eancampus.org and explore top quality content. More details in the episode description.
Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Gianmarco Abadessa and I am Research Fellow at University of Campania Luigi Vanvitelli. And in today's episode, we will talk about basic immunology in rare CNS disorders. My guest today is Professor Heinz Windel. Prof. Windel is head of the Department of Neurology and Neurophysiology in Freiburg since October 2024. And his research focuses on inflammatory neurodegeneration and immune regulation and protection, as well as monitoring MS and its therapy. Welcome, Professor Windel, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Gianmarco. Absolutely happy to be here, and thanks for the invitation.
Okay, so we can start, and I would start asking some introductory questions. The first one is, what are the key immune mechanisms driving CNS autoimmunity? And is the concept of the CNS as an immune privileged site still valid?
So, I mean, we're considering a aberrant or dysfunctional immune response against CNS structures as sterile inflammation. So we're not talking about an infectious pathogen, we're talking about a sterile inflammation. And that is actually the basis of CNS autoimmunity or autoimmune CNS disorders. The concept that CNS is immune privileged has been revised very strongly over the last years. On the other hand, it's still true that immune reactions in the CNS behave a bit differently, and they are, in a way, also differently mounted as opposed to things like the liver. And simple things like the blood-brain barrier are structurally, histopathologically different than other organs. So it's true that the CNS is in a way protected in a different way from outside damage and pathogens, which is probably the basis for it. On the other hand, it's unfortunately still possible that the CNS is the target of an immune attack.
Thank you for your answer. And so another introductory question is about IgG subclasses. I'm curious to know the different IgG subclasses and their distinct functions in neuroimmunological diseases.
Yeah, that's also an interesting question. I mean, first and foremost, not all the diseases that may be considered as rare neuroimmunological diseases are antibody-mediated or immunoglobulin-dominated. On the other hand, if you focus on those, the advantage that you know one of the key culprits, and as you know, we have different immunoglobulin subclasses. I mean, everybody knows IgG, immunoglobulin G. I guess everybody knows IgM, which is the acute phase. And then you have IgA and IgE. But even within the IgGs, we have different subclasses. And that's relevant because not all the immunoglobulins trigger subsequently the same cascades of immunological amplifications. For example, IgG4 is very relevant subclass of immunopathies, but does not activate complement system. So you can sub-characterize certain immunological reactions in the central nervous system by the dominating immunoglobulin class. What you can memorize is that all of the chronic CNS autoimmune disorders, they are not dominated by IgM, they are dominated by IgG.
Now, before going through some specific rare autoimmune disease, I would ask you to mention which rare CNS autoimmune disorder should clinicians be aware of, and how do they differ immunologically from multiple sclerosis? In brief, because we are going to delve into them specifically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're diving into them a little bit more specifically, but the most frequent, albeit in its totality, still not super frequent disease is multiple sclerosis. We have learned over the last years that there is rare, but potentially very paradigmatic autoimmune disorders, and one inflammatory disease which has been considered part of MS for many, many decades is neuromyelitis optica spectrum disease. The other is MOG-associated disease. They are classified as related disease to multiple sclerosis. Then there is other diseases that are very different. Susak syndrome, Rasmussen encephalitis. And there is this big but still heterogeneous subgroup of so-called synoptopathies, which most people characterized clinically as so-called autoimmune encephalitis. And there is also a last subgroup, which I would like to mention. It's antibody-related neurological autoimmunity, and that has been triggered mostly because of checkpoint inhibitors. So you're unleashing immune responses against the tumor, but they create collateral damage. And in some patients, they create inflammatory reactivity against peripheral, but also central nervous system structure, and that's immune checkpoint-related neurological complications. I guess I've listed the most important ones, at least those we might want to talk about in the podcast now.
So we are ready to go in deep, and let's delve into neuromyelitis optica and MOG-associated disease. Could you outline their key immunological features and the immune players involved, and also a focus on what are the commonalities and differences between the two?
This is an interesting story of, let's say, neuroimmunology in general. So neuromyelitis optica, it's nowadays called neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorders, is a group of disorders that are characterized by an aberrant immune reactivity against a water channel mostly expressed on astrocytes. It's aquaporin 4. And that was the breakthrough in distinguishing this disease from multiple sclerosis. It is clinically very different, but some overlaps clearly exist. And it's a very antibody-dominated disease. MOGAD has been characterized as a, call it, third entity only very recently, noting that MOG, myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein, has been considered a putative autoantigen in multiple sclerosis, but it has turned out that this is not a consistent feature. But in MOG-associated disease, which is clinically but also pathologically different from NMOSD, but also multiple sclerosis, this is the hallmark. The existence of antibodies against myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein. And I mean, in those diseases, the target antigen also defines the clinical pattern, because most of what happens in those diseases is to be characterized by the attack against the histopathologically definable target structure, either aquaporin 4 or MOG.
Okay, and just to know, this difference, how this difference can explain the different response to anti-CD20 and complement inhibitors?
Absolutely. NMOSD is an extremely elegant example where the characterization of the immune pathogenesis, mostly the existence of aquaporin 4 antibodies and its related consequences, have triggered and raised therapeutic development. And the therapeutic development was an extreme success story because aquaporin 4 antibodies trigger in a very vigorous way complement. And by using complement inhibition, you can control the disease nearly by 90 to 100%, which is fabulous, which is unprecedented. And thereby, you can say you can learn pathogenesis via therapeutic intervention. The dependency on complement is much, much less with MORC, albeit it's there and it hasn't been formally studied in a clinical trial. And it's, of course, there, but much less also in multiple sclerosis. So what you can learn out of that is that if you're characterizing the dominant pathogenic principle, and if the pathogenic principle is rather homogeneous within the spectrum of the disease, a consecutive therapeutic development and a rational for this therapeutic development is much easier. You mentioned B-cell depletion and B-cell targeting. And if you talk about the elimination of B-cells with CD20 antibodies or CD19 antibodies, then you're eliminating basically a large segment of B-cells that have a lot to do with antibody production, but also immune regulation, B-cell, T-cell cooperation. And interestingly, B-cell depletion works in all those entities, not because all those entities are to a similar extent driven by antibodies, but B-cells play a crucial role in the disturbed immune regulatory networks.
So we cannot consider B-cell depletion therapy, if we want to see it, as you described, a very targeted therapy, because it's like what, right? Wide spectrum therapy, where it, so the efficacy is due to the depletion, the elimination of an entire arm of the immune system. And so now we can go to the next topic that is autoimmune encephalitis, that represents a diverse groups of disorders. Could you explain the differences between autoantibodies targeting cell surface synaptic versus intracellular antigens and their clinical implications?
Yeah, let's move to the autoimmune encephalitis. I mean, historically, autoimmune encephalitis has been, in a way, described and clinically realized as different encephalitis subforms, different from the so-called paraneoplastic syndromes. And the first one in this class, call it like that, was limbic encephalitis. And in contrast to the other diseases that we just described, the response of the immune system is against neurons. So the target structures are mostly expressed on neuronal cells, which gives a completely different set of clinical consequences. And the first one that has been described is NMDA receptor encephalitis. And that occurs mostly as a non-paraneoplastic condition, mostly in female. And that has given rise to a disease group that is called synoptopathy. So cell surface structures that are mostly related to synapses. And if the immune response is directed against this, you have very clear neurological deficits that are partly extremely impressive, neuropsychological deficits, epileptic seizures, and so forth. And meanwhile, there have been descriptions of a large variety of target structures on the surface. The paraneoplastic immune responses, they are targeting intracellular antigens mostly, things like GUT, glutamate decarboxylase, and they are very different. And the key feature, albeit antibodies are detected, is CD8 cells. So while the ones are mostly dominated by antibodies, the intracellular ones are actually driven more by cytotoxic T cells and are in general much harder to immunologically treat, and very more often are a consequence of concomitant tumor disease, not always, but more frequently. So it's again within this class, two different immunopathological traits.
And I suppose that the differences you discussed also explain the different response to, again, anti-CD20 therapy also in these cases.
Absolutely. As I just tried to make clear, I mean, if you go from very selective therapies, things like plasma exchange, where you eliminate antibodies, they will clearly only work if antibodies do the job. And that's the difference between antibodies there to help in characterizing the diagnosis, as opposed to they are really the dominant pathogenetic players or culprits. And the different response to B-cell depletion is also partly explained by exactly this. If the key feature is a CD8 response against an intracellular pathogen, B-cell depletion is much less effective, as we know, for example, for gut encephalitis, as opposed to classically antibody-driven sub-entities, things like NMDA receptor encephalitis, where it's much, much easier. Probably we don't have the time to go through all these distinct antibody features, but just to make up the principle. The principle is as we indicated, cell surface as opposed to intracellular. And that partly explains a large portion of the pathogenesis already. But they all have in common that they mostly target, and that's different to the first diseases that we discussed, they target neuronal structures.
So now we can go to immune checkpoint inhibitor-associated neurological disease. And my first question is, are checkpoint inhibitor-induced neurological syndromes a distinct neurological entity, or are we observing a classical autoimmune encephalitis that has been triggered by immune activation?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I mean, you have, if you want to make it up a little bit more categorically, in my opinion, two different ways to look at it. So first, you have to say, and that's maybe to set the stage, what are these checkpoint inhibitors really doing? I mean, if you're thinking of activating an immune response, let's say a T cell activation, you need an antigen specific signal, which is either the autoantigen or a pathogen that is recognized. But this alone is not sufficient. And if you use the second signal, it's the so-called co-stimulatory signal, this then helps to trigger and mount the immune response and the activation of T cell. The T cells secrete cytokines, they start proliferate. So you need a signal one and you need a signal two. What checkpoint inhibitors are doing, they are basically blocking signal two, which means that a inhibitory signal is inhibited and then you're unleashing the brakes. And that's basically inverting what happens in autoimmunity, where you try to control putative antigen-reactive, autoantigen-reactive T cells. And what happens then is that by collateral damage among the multitude of immune reactivities, you're also unleashing the brakes in putative autoreactive cells. And that is then category one, you're unmasking a latent pre-existing autoimmune disease. And then you could say that's really very similar to autoimmunity. The second category is much more frequent. It's a transient dysimmunopathy against CNS structures. They look similar, but not pathogenetically identically to classical encephalitis. You could make the same point with myositis or myasthenia gravis. And that's because the pathogenesis is very selectively depending on unleashed T cells and not so much of anything else. So you don't have antibodies in addition. You don't have the complete spectrum and orchestra of dysregulated elements of the immune system. So you're mostly reducing it to T cells. And that's a mimic, but it's not identically pathogenetically. And I guess this is what you have to consider the difference also therapeutically, because some of the therapeutic principles that we apply in those diseases, they don't work to the same extent in this immune checkpoint inhibitor-related CNS complications, because it's really only T cells, more or less.
Now, I would ask, do these syndromes have a different immunological signature compared to spontaneous autoimmune CNS disorders? Actually, I think we have partly discussed this.
Yeah, exactly. We have partly discussed it, and that's what I tried to make conceptually as a difference. I mean, if you're prone to, let's say, CNS autoimmunity, you have a certain genetic component, you have a certain disease evolution, as opposed to something that is probably best explained with the concept of molecular mimicry, that you have a cross recognition, but in this case, only a very segmented element of the immune system. So pathogenetically, they are not the same. And this is why they are an interesting learning part. So they are then also differently to treat.
Last question about this topic. What about the balance between the autoimmunity control and cancer immunotherapy? When we are in a condition where the therapy of the cancer has promoted and exacerbated the disease, what we should do? How to balance the two?
Yeah, it's a pretty good question. I mean, if you talk with oncologists, they see quite a couple of immune-related adverse events, but they very often take this price that they pay because they are voting against surviving cancer. So this collateral damage by unleashing the immune system and then accepting all sorts of inflammatory syndromes, including CNS autoimmunity mimics, it's accepted by the oncologist because the higher value is survival of the patient. On the other hand, it's a very interesting learning point. So usually the indication for those checkpoint inhibitors are done by the oncologist, and the price of secondary autoimmunity or autoimmune syndrome, or call it inflammatory syndromes, is simply accepted. On the other hand, what you want to raise in any specific cancer situation is an enhanced immune reactivity. And that's basically the black and white, the yin and yang of the risk of generating autoimmunity. So a lot of questions that people in the cancer immunology field are trying to address are basically the same as in the autoimmunity field, just inverted. So what you do want to have to enhance, it's ideally suppressed. So when we're talking about checkpoint inhibition, basically what you would like to do in autoimmunity is the inverted thing. You wanna put the brakes on otherwise unregulated or not sufficiently regulated autoimmune reactive cells. So I guess this is a long winding road to the answer. Basically, conceptually and immunologically, we have a very good understanding what happens there, but it's not possible at this point to individually predict it.
Thank you for your answer. And now we can go toward the end. And the first question is, beyond the diseases we discussed, are there other rare CNS autoimmune conditions that deserve more research attention?
Well, I have to say that apart from what we have discussed, I would particularly say that Susak syndrome and Rasmussen encephalitis, they have created a lot of attention because they have been identified as paradigms of CNS autoimmune conditions with different targets. So in Susak syndrome, our group, together with others, colleagues in Toulouse and Vienna, we have described Susak syndrome as a paradigm of a CD8 T cell mediated endotheliopathy. So the immune response, very different from what we discussed until now, is going against brain endothelium only. And in Rasmussen encephalitis, it's the paradigm of a CD8-mediated neural response, with a difference to all the other diseases, it's locally restricted. So it's not across the complete CNS, it's just affecting one hemisphere. And that's a big learning point, because you can ask yourself how that happens. So this is two very paradigmatic diseases. There is a third one, which is also extremely paradigmatic. It's narcolepsy. Narcolepsy, it's directed immune response against a very small, tiny neuronal population that is expressing orexin 1. And has raised a lot of attention because it has this relation to a certain vaccination, flu vaccine, which made an incredibly important learning point about molecular mimicry in the CNS. So that's three diseases which we believe we have a very deep understanding. We can model it also partly in animal models. And we have in some of those diseases identified the antigen. Narcolepsy, but in the others, we are still lacking this information. That's an extremely important road to further our understanding here.
And now, as last question, what do you see as the most promising immunological targets for future therapies in these disorders?
While we have learned so much and we are getting better and better in immune selective treatments, none of them is antigen specific yet. And some of those diseases would qualify, in my opinion, for the revival of the holy grail of neuroimmunology, means a reinducing antigen specific tolerance. And this is particularly a good rationale when you are clearly aware of the antigen, for example, in NMO spectrum diseases, where you can induce antigen-specific tolerance mechanisms. Beyond that, I guess the call is for a very pathogenetically oriented disease modification and immunological interrogation. I mean, we've seen that very elegantly with complement targeting, which in a way is, it's much more funneled towards a very selective mechanism as opposed to, as we discussed, B-cell depletion, which is not that specific at all. And that's, I guess, where the field will probably move to, or hopefully will move to.
Thank you very much. So we are going toward the more targeted and precision medicine. And maybe this is my thought, is that we are going toward this thanks to omic science, especially thanks to omic science. So to sequencing, and especially thanks to single cell sequencing, that are techniques that allow to understand in more detail the target and who do the job also.
Exactly. So completely right. This is what I call precision neuroimmunology. Diagnosis, prognosis, therapy will be better targetable and better understood and better to be stratified based on those signatures and multi-layer signatures that we are using. Different technologies are getting more and more into our not only academic practice, but also hopefully soon also in routine patient care.
Thank you, Prof. Windel, for joining us today and sharing your valuable insights on rare neuroimmunological disorder of the CNS. We explored the immune mechanism behind CNS cell immunity, emphasizing that while the CNS is not impermeable, it still retains significant immune privilege due to the blood-brain barrier and specificity compared to other tissues. Also, we understood, my opinion is that one of the main messages is that to understand the pathogenesis of the different rare immune disease and why they respond to specific immune therapy, we need to understand who do the job, if antibodies do the job or they are just a biomarker, and also who is the target, which cell is the target. We also touched on regional attacks in diseases like Rasmussen, encephalitis, and narcolepsy, where immune responses are localized, affecting specific areas of the brain. And looking ahead, the future of neuroimmunology points to exciting advancements in precision medicine, the discovery of new immunological targets for rare CNS autoimmune diseases. Thank you also to the listeners.
Thanks very much for the conversation.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.